everybody. So obviously we're running really late. I do think this is the most important part of what we do, is get to know each other a little. Is this on? So this part of the, first let me introduce Rabbi David Kasher, who is not yet introduced, who is, I believe, the educational director of Keva, which is a very interesting organization that brings people together in small groups for regular text study. So he's an expert in what we're about to do, which is some, let's say, interreligious text study, and he'll explain, he'll introduce the text that he brought, and Professor Barani will introduce the text that she's brought. And I'll just say that along with being a rabbi and an educator, I think you're also working on your PhD in the law school, is that right? So just in case anyone was insufficiently impressed with the beginning of this introduction. So I'm gonna turn the microphone over to Rabbi Kasher, Professor Barani, who will introduce their text and help us get divided into smaller groups where we can have intimate text study in the way that we
I just want to start by saying I feel such a deep sense of kinship with Islam on so many levels. I think it's more obvious with Islam than with any other religious tradition that we're praying to the same God. It's so explicit. And so many of the parallels between our two traditions have already been mentioned today, but I think one of the most exciting is the tradition of Islamic scholarship that's so familiar to me as someone who spends his life in Jewish study. And so everyone who is acquainted with either of those traditions will know that it is not study in the academic sense. It is this sort of special merger that our traditions are managed to facilitate between the intellectual and the spiritual. And somehow by reading through our sacred texts and talking through them together, we are having a kind of spiritual experience. Our minds are sort of elevating to the divine mind, if you will. And so we are going to do that by putting these two traditions in conversation with one another. And in some ways, you're just going to go through the conversation that Nargis and I had when we put these texts together. I started thinking about pilgrimage, and the obvious place to go is another parallel point in our two traditions. We have very established obligatory communal or collective pilgrimage festivals in Judaism. The obvious place to start thinking about pilgrimage in Judaism is the three pilgrimage fests. Shalosh Pamim B'Shana, three times a year, you go up and you appear before the Lord your God and you bring an offering. And those festivals, does anyone know what they're called? They're regalim, that's one word. And the other word is chag. Chag Sukkot, we have Passover, we have Sukkot, and Shavuot. But the word Chag will sound familiar to everyone, both in Hebrew, and most people think is a word that is connected to the word Hajj. So we really, we hear the similarities between our two traditions. So anyway, that is the obvious place to go, but I thought for this text study, maybe we shouldn't go to the obvious place, so I began thinking about a different kind of pilgrimage, one that is more intimate and more personal. What is it like to be called to your own personal pilgrimage in contrast to these kind of these collective pilgrimage festivals? And I came across this passage in a mystical tradition that was already mentioned by a previous rabbi, the Hasidic tradition, where one of the famous masters of that tradition, Rabbi Nachman of Breslov, in the introduction to his famous work, his student says, this whole work was only made possible through a particular pilgrimage, which you'll read about. Anyway, I shared this text with Nargis, and immediately she responded with a parallel mystical tradition in Islam. And so we're going to be sort of looking at sort of some of the less obvious pilgrimages or pilgrimage ideas as they appear in our two traditions. And they're not exactly the same. And that's, I think, one of the things that we wanted you to see is that the incredible parallels, but also some of the distinctions between the two. So you have a text. I think to follow our line of thought, since I handed a text to her and then she handed one to me, maybe start with the one that that says on the front, personal pilgrimage. I want us to think about that. What is personal pilgrimage as opposed to collective pilgrimage? And if you need some help making your way through the text, there's some guiding questions at the bottom. And then you can turn to the photocopy of a text that I'll let you introduce, give a little bit of context to it.
So as Rabbi Kasher mentioned, I was very inspired by this tradition of the Hasidic text. And I looked at it, and this is one of my all-time favorite poems. I read it each time. I have a moment of thinking about pilgrimage, but it fits so nicely. And the questions that he has posed at the end of the first text, I think, were generally applicable to both of them. So this is a 10th century poet, a very famous Iranian poet, by the name of Nasir Khusro. So Iran seems to get a lot of, rightly so today. And he is considered the greatest, one of the greatest of Persian poets in terms of even linguistic style. However, he converted from Sunni Islam at some point, whatever we want to call in our sort of modern terms, a midlife crisis, something of the sort that happened, and converted to a more a tradition that is a minority tradition, a Shia, and among the Shias, the Ismaili tradition. However, he was a great intellectual, and really, having recently revisited a lot of his divan, a huge divan, which is really, one can categorize it as philosophical poetry. This is a poem that he writes, and somewhere he says, "Perhaps I overstepped my bounds." So he is questioning the pilgrim who's coming back from having performed the Hajj in this particular case and asking many important questions. Nasir Khusro, with the quote earlier from Saadi, many of these Persian poets and thinkers really can be categorized as the greatest humanists, and ethics and ethicality in rituals particularly, but in every aspect of human life, went way above everything else. And that's what he's doing here. So this whole notion that David and I were talking about, the personal, on the one hand the communal and the personal, and how he combines the two, I thought you would all find interesting. So Naomi had the idea of breaking about groups of five. What do you think?
Normally we use these little alcoves.
Yeah, so we've got
alcoves are quite hot. So I'm wondering if has anyone been outside? Is it cooler outside?
Yes.
So what I would say is, why don't you break it up into groups of, let's say, between 5 and 10? And the only thing is that try not to segregate yourself in the way I hear happens at Berkeley High in the cafeteria. In other words, mix it up a little. The idea is to meet people that you don't hang out with all the time, and find the coolest spot you can. And there's too much confusion, we'll try to make it happen, but we're hoping it'll happen.
And I also think, try and mix it up. I mean, if there's too many Jews in your circle, maybe like you need to reshuffle with too many Muslims. Like, try and mix it up that way too. I think we want the
that's
people as well as the text to be in.
I was trying to say that delicately.
Obvious, but that's what she meant.
Yeah.
And so take about a few minutes reading the Jewish text to start with, then read the poem, and then see where your groups go. And David and I will be circulating in each of the groups if you have questions. The idea is, we don't have a whole lot of time, but ideally if we can come back, depending on the number of people, maybe even for a 5 or 7 minute at the end to bring it together. And if you, anybody in your group, if you want to designate a person, you can volunteer and you get a minute to tell us what went on in your group that was etched in your memory. So 1 minute, one person per group. Hopefully, if we have 6 to 7 groups, we can come back together and talk about it, which will be followed by the reception and the music.
Let's come back, and I think what we're just going to do is here. Every group, I believe, has sort of unofficially appointed a representative to share some of the insights that might have come up in the discussion. I sat with one of the groups, and the discussion was really rich. Hopefully it wasn't every group. So raise your hand if you're one of the representatives.
Our group didn't have one.
Didn't have one, so Marty and who, Rena, are you gonna?
Rena and Ibrahim.
Rena and Ibrahim. Great, so why don't, and maybe
group, somebody has
somebody
to,
has to volunteer from your group. All right, so let's start with Ibrahim.
No, ladies first.
Okay, let's start with Rena.
Sorry, Rena. We had a great personal story by...
Why don't you come up to the mic if you don't mind
here.
So too much?
Let me just, yeah.
Okay, all right.
See
I'm
the
mic. A loud voice. Can you give me the second? Okay. So we had a really beautiful personal story by Rabbi Gabay about a personal pilgrimage to Morocco and to the grave of her grandfather. The shared tradition of pilgrimage among both Jews and Muslims to shared holy sites and graves, both of personal importance and also of sort of importance broadly within the religious tradition that we have shared pilgrimage sites. And if you can get Rabbi Gabay after she sings to tell you the story, it's a really beautiful story.
It is. I'd love to for the group to hear it.
All right, you want to pass it? Pass on?
Thank you. So, yeah, we talked about like juxtaposing a whole bunch of different things, and one of them was like of the extent to which pilgrimage is internal and it happens on an empty stomach, I guess we can say. The whole idea of being hungry for spiritual knowledge comes. And then that goes against, but it is contrasted with the idea of there being a space where one goes in order to find this great revelation from God himself. So the rabbi's journey to Israel in order to find the wisdom of God, as opposed to someone who goes to Mecca to really find these things within themselves. And then there was some discussion of this thing called Al-Kahf, which is in the Quran. It talks about the pilgrimage, so to speak, of Musa, who goes looking for this man who's going to take him on this journey so he can have a greater knowledge of God. And that greater knowledge actually turned out to be about his own flaws and himself and the wisdom of God bringing us in that. So it was good. It was very good. And like the rabbi here and Brian here, first story to just talk to the implications. Well done.
Awesome. Okay, from this group, I think Marty was going to share.
Hi, so we approached it by reading the story of the rabbi and then reading the story, reading the poem, and try to focus on the questions that were listed.
Marty, can you bring that poem to me?
Yes.
Guess not.
Okay, maybe not. Doesn't like it. Doesn't like that type of group.
We had a discussion
much
of just how to interpret the Persian poem. Was it a pilgrim who was just going in a mechanical way, not thinking that much about it? Was he not educated in his faith? Was he expecting to have a transformation and was disappointed when he came back? And we had some discussion of that. In terms of the rabbi going to the Holy Land, I had a minority view which fell flat, and that is, I said, I don't believe the rabbi ever went to the Holy Land. I think that this was set up in an exaggerated way to tell Jews, look, you always talk about Jerusalem and the Holy Land and you never go. You sit in the shtetl in courts or something and all you do is talk, but you don't enlighten yourself and you don't go. We had some discussion about whether a pilgrimage has to include hardships in order to sort of get the full benefits or not. I don't know if we came to a conclusion. And I think that was sort of some of the points that we were trying to work out.
Awesome. Has anyone self-appointed themselves willing to report back a little bit from the last group here?
Steph. Okay, Steph needs to be here.
Right. Here's Steph right here,
front row. Thanks, Steph.
Okay, I'll say a few things, and if I forgot something, my group can fill it in. We talked about whether you have to go somewhere to have a pilgrimage, or if you can have that transformation without the travel. We talked about whether it's going through the motions or if it's all internal. And we talked about whether you can judge somebody else's pilgrimage and the spirituality of another person. I don't know if anyone wants to add something from my group that I forgot.
That's interesting.
I'll just repeat the question that I felt like we were circling around in our group, which is just a really simple one, I think, that a lot of these issues touch on, which is just what is a good pilgrimage exactly? What would constitute a, if you will, a successful pilgrimage? And I think on the one end of that spectrum, it's just, if you go. I think in both of our traditions, there's this notion that action is what really matters in one paradigm. Just go and you've done the pilgrimage, congratulations. And on the other end of the spectrum, there's this notion that it doesn't matter unless there's been a real internal experience, some sort of transformative internal experience. And sort of how we balance between action as a value in itself and then some less tangible internal spiritual happening or phenomenon, I think is a question that's underlying a lot of these discussions. Do you want to offer any last?
No, I thought that people really were great in terms of sort of looking at the text and where the challenging notions were. In the Nasir Khosrow text, of course, there were quite a few challenges, and we talked about this whole question, you know, what Stephanie mentioned in one of the groups is about judgment. But when I was in the smaller group here, I also loved the story of, you know, how the two traditions, in terms of Rio, which is your story of having an Arab brother, and actually asking your mom whether you were a Jew or an Arab, what was happening there, and, you know, those kind of intricate, I would love for you to share that. Yeah, so,
yeah, that's very cool.
Yeah, I would love for you to share. We have a couple of minutes, and then if we have time, I'll come back.
And David, I mean, you're really the only scholar here that we haven't heard very much from, so if you would like to speak some basic issues.
Great, so
right,
do you want to
after Sydney,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Well, actually this story I always share with my students because I think it's such a magnificent story to show how we were all created in God's image and we have the same needs and how beautifully we can get along, even though you can be very religious, like my mother who was a wife of a rabbi and a daughter of a rabbi. So the story takes place in early 50s in the land of Israel, and they lived in a little tiny little village, it's called Chosen, up in the north, which was surrounded by some Arab villages. And I wasn't born yet, and but my mom had my youngest brother. I'm the youngest of nine, so there were 20 kids. My brother was a baby, about 1 year old, and the moshav where my parents lived and the Arab village, they were like maybe a mile. But in between them, they had the lands that were growing tobacco leaves. And my mother from the window sees this Arab woman. She knew she was there just by, you know, her clothing and carrying a little baby and picking up the tobacco leaves. It was very hot in middle of July in Israel. And my mother approached the lady and said to her in Arabic, since my parents are from Morocco and they speak the language, she said to her, "My sister, why are you walking or working with this infant? You're going to kill him with this heat." And the woman said, "I don't have anyone to leave the baby with, and I have to work to sustain myself." My mom says, "Look, I have a baby at home, I have children, why don't you come in? And I'm at home, let me take care of the child, and you come in and nurse him once in a while, he's right here." And in the beginning, the woman would come back and forth, and then sometimes the baby was hungry and the mother wasn't to be found, she was a little farther. So what do you think? We have here many mothers, what do you do when you see an infant crying? You have, thank God, two of them. You just pull one out, give one to your child and one to the other baby. So she was nursing this baby, his name was Awad, and he was calling my mother Mama, and his mother Omi. So I was growing up with Owad coming a lot to my parents' home, and his mother, I knew she was Arab, coming, and we're going, and at one point, I was maybe five, I said to my mom, Ma, Ima, Abba is a rabbi, are we Arabs or Jews? What are we? That was because, and she said, no, it's I nursed him when he was a baby, and he's like, he's my son, too. He is like your brother. So I grew up with this man who I always refer to him as my brother. And I traveled all the way from the state to his wedding when he got married, and when his children were born. And when my parents passed away, he actually said Shiva with us and mourned with us and let his beard grow. And just like any of us, and we're still very close. Unfortunately, a year ago he passed away, all of a sudden, young man, from a heart attack, but we are very close with his wife and the children and the grandchildren. And it's just, I shared it to just because I thought, I don't know why, it came up. So thank you for letting me share.
Thank
this.
You for sharing this.
Maybe I'll just end by I just suggested one tension or spectrum that between action and experience. Maybe I'll just end by introducing another one, and that is the tension between the sort of the personal and nature of a pilgrimage, and on the other hand, the sort of the divine desire for pilgrimage. You know, in the Hebrew, the verses that speak of pilgrimage, three times a year it says yira'eh, you one shall be seen in the place that God will choose. Not you go and you see, but you shall be seen. And then it follows it up by saying, and you shouldn't show up reikam, you shouldn't show up empty-handed. You should bring something for God. So you have these three, this notion that you will be seen, God will choose the place, and you will bring something to God. And that's a very different model than these last texts that we've been discussing, which are really about a kind of personal transformative experience. But there is a paradigm of pilgrimage where, and maybe it fits with the just go do it side of the other spectrum, where you're just going to do it because actually God wants to see you. The pilgrimage is for God. And obviously, you know, God is, you know, the most controversial and complicated topic, and we all strive for non-simplistic, sophisticated notions of God, but whatever God is, it suggests something outside of me, something outside of my personal desire and experience, and maybe that's part of the pilgrimage process too. And of course, it's not a strict binary. It's not either for me or for God. There is this notion that maybe doing something from force outside of myself will transform me. Being seen by God will have a personal effect on me. Going to the place that I haven't chosen, that God chose, that does something that shifts my orientation to the world. And giving something, ultimately, I gain from that experience. So I think that's another notion maybe to insert into this very rich conversation. It's very, very much an honor to work with Narkiz and all of you. It's been a really fascinating discussion.
So I absolutely, from this particular one, the South African Hajj, one of the sentences that a friend tells this couple that's going is, don't go with preconceived notions of what you will be looking for there. Because if you keep doing that, you will miss what God has for you. And so there's never a binary, right? Whether it is one, you know, the physicality, and somebody can say, well, the internal is, you know, more important, more meaningful, but who knows what, you know, what is beloved to God and what is meant for each. And there again, you know, the great Rumi story is perfect. Do I have 1 minute to tell it?
Mm-hmm.
No.
Yes.
You must ask.
But it was Moses. And
then it's okay.
It's okay. It's Moses and the shepherd. So apparently Moses has this, you know, rendezvous or his date, appointed time to go meet God. And he's going through the desert, according to Rumi. And he comes across a little hut, where he hears some conversation. And he hears about, when you come to my place, I will welcome you. I will take the lice off from your hair. I will, you know, bathe you. And then I will oil you. I will massage you. I'll give you the best bed. So Moses is wondering, you know, which VIP is in there that this person is talking about or calling. he goes the shepherds along, and so he looks at the shepherd and says, who are you talking to? And, you know, who do you want to treat in such high manner? And the shepherd looks at Moses and said, I was talking to God. And Moses gets really angry. And he said, such blasphemous words. Do you think God is a human person that has lice in his hair that you want to take off? You want to give him the best of your goat's milk? You want to oil and massage him? What do you think God is? How dare you talk to God like that? Of course, the person is devastated, probably like the pilgrim in our poem. He's devastated, and Moses goes on, according to Rumi, goes further and comes to his appointed place and time with God and waits, because remember, the Muslim tradition, he actually speaks to God. He's the Kalimullah, so he waits, and no such thing happens, and he waits and waits for several days and falls asleep, and in the dream, he hears God's voice that says, oh Moses, I sent you down to join humans to me, to join humankind to me, not to break it. You have really hurt, and you've broken the heart of my very devout servant. And I'm very upset with you, I'm very angry with you, I do not want to talk to you. You've got to understand that those words, if they came from your mouth, that would be blasphemy. Oh. But coming from the mouth of that humble shepherd, they were as sweet and as beloved to me as if, you know, you had this any other learned person doing this. So now it's Moses' turn to be devastated by none other than God, right? So he asks for forgiveness and says he has to go and ask for forgiveness to the shepherd and give him the good news. So he backtracks, he comes back and goes into the little hut, and there is nobody there. And so Moses again goes, you know, to the footsteps and starts walking, and you know, finally finds the shepherd somewhere in the desert and says, you know, hey, wait on, I have really good news for you. Wait up, the guy isn't listening. Moses goes close to him and shakes him up and says, I have really good news for you. God says he accepts your prayer no matter what and how you say it. Mm-hmm. And the guy has no expression on his face. And Moses shakes him up again and says, do you understand? I'm bringing God's message for you specifically. And he says, he accepts your prayer. And this guy looks straight into Moses' eyes and says, I'm beyond that.
Okay.